This is Active Lehigh Valley on 88.1 WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio.
Welcome to Active Lehigh Valley, generously supported by St. Luke's University Health Network. Our aim with this program is to encourage listeners to be happy, healthy, and active. I'm your host this evening, Margaret McConnell. Tonight, we're speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Jarry, Senior Vice President of Medical and Academic Affairs of St. Luke's University Health Network. Dr. Jarry is an infectious disease specialist and is here tonight to educate us on Lyme disease as we head into the thick of summer. Welcome, Dr. Jarry.
Thank you, Margaret. It's a pleasure to be here with you and your audience.
Yes, and we're happy to have you here to tell us how we can be safe while we're being active outside this summer. So there are some things we need to be aware of, and one of those is ticks and Lyme disease. Can you tell us what Lyme disease is and why we should be worried about it as the weather starts to get warmer?
Absolutely. So first of all, Lyme disease is a bacterial disease. It's caused by a bacteria that is in the class Borrelia, generally Borrelia burgdorferi. And it is known as a vector-borne disease. What do we mean by that? It's a disease that's transmitted from one host to another. In many cases, we're that second host by way of an intermediary, and that intermediary is, in many cases, an insect or an arthropod, another type of arthropod. And in the case of Lyme disease, we're talking about ticks. So one of the things to be aware of is this is certainly not a rare disease. It is estimated that if we want to use a strict reporting system, the CDC has that. But when you actually look at expanding it, we know that there's at least a 500,000 individuals every year that come down with Lyme disease. And more importantly to our audience, well, we often say that our area, like Pennsylvania, may not lead the country in a number of things, but one of the things it does lead in is in absolute numbers of Lyme disease patients. It is something that really should be important to all of us. It is not rare, anything but that. And I might also add that it closely follows in our bordering communities in terms of New Jersey as well as New York. So we can talk about the areas where it's most prevalent, but our area leads the country.
And certainly during the summer, we have a lot of people that vacation in our neighboring states of New Jersey and New York. So important to know the risks there. So you mentioned ticks. How specifically can you get Lyme disease?
So the bacteria is present in ticks that can become infected with it. And how do they do that? We should know something a little bit about the tick life cycle. The tick that we're talking about right now that transmits Lyme disease is known as the black-legged tick or deer tick in our area. This tick has a life cycle that is either 2 to 3 years. The parts of the life cycle where transmission occurs to us are either in the nymphal stage or the adult stage. So ticks aren't born with this. What happens is that they end up contracting it because they have to have blood meals in order to survive. And usually their first blood meal is frequently in rodents or birds. So we're talking about things like squirrels or mice that may be infected with this. And in many cases, these hosts don't show any signs of it, but they have the bacteria. Then the tick ingests that, and then during their next evolution or blood meal, we oftentimes are an accidental host. They can then go on to usually larger mammals like deer and dogs and in some cases livestock, but obviously humans are also in that category. When the tick bites us, and the tick has this particular type of bacteria, and it's embedded to us for a period of time. And that's very important because, in general, the tick usually needs to be embedded for more than 24 hours in order to transfer the bacteria into us. Then we can obviously come down with symptoms. Now, obviously, not everyone who gets bitten by an infected tick is going to develop symptoms or even get the disease, but a certain percentage do.
Okay. So what are some of those symptoms?
All right. So it has been sort of classical to divide these symptoms up into various stages, but that can sometimes be confusing because in many cases the stages can coexist with each other. So the first things that tend to happen are that one may have a fever, they may have a headache, they may have fatigue, and in many cases, anywhere between 40 to 80%, depending on what type of article you're looking at, there's a rash. And the rash can be fairly characteristic. It's been called a bullseye rash that expands, and it's known as ECM or erythema chronicum migrans. And then if it's not treated in particular, it can go to other symptoms, certain neurologic symptoms like having paralysis of the facial nerve that is known as Bell's palsy and can obviously also spread to joints, giving you arthritis, having certain types of heart block or heart disease, as well as certain other infections of the nervous system, including meningitis. So it is a disease that you want to try and pick up early. We always say, as with most diseases, first of all, prevention is always better than treatment, and early treatment is generally better than late treatment, and that's certainly true of Lyme disease.
So can Lyme disease have different effects based on your age?
In fact, what happens is when we want to look at the demographics of Lyme disease, we find that there are certain individuals that tend to be more prone to get it. And they usually are, if we look at, first of all, men in general, if we're talking about the under 60 age group, particularly under the age of 16 is a high demographic area, and from the ages of 30 to 60. And it may have to do with the time that's spent outdoors and where you're going to be exposed where these ticks live. And I do want to be able to get into, when we talk about prevention, you know, where you might find these ticks. So that's certainly one demographic. The second thing is that we do know that if you're older, over the age of 60, the symptoms may be the same, but you're much more likely to display those symptoms than a younger individual who may not have the symptoms at all. So that's one of the big differences in terms of ages.
So you can actually have Lyme disease and not have any symptoms?
Absolutely.
So it can go on undetected and it doesn't cause you any problems?
It may not, yeah.
Okay, interesting. So what are some of the places you mentioned that Pennsylvania is one of the states that ranks highest for Lyme disease? Where are you likely to encounter ticks, and how can we avoid them?
Okay, so let me also try and give you some type of overview of where Lyme disease is most prevalent. So we did mention that mid-Atlantic states, where Pennsylvania is certainly in that category, the northeastern states definitely are, and the upper Midwest. These are areas that are prime. There are also some hot spots in parts of California. At the same token, though, it's well to kind of think about that Lyme disease can be present virtually anywhere. Supposedly, it's been reported in all 50 states, but the one state where there's a little bit of controversy about that is Hawaii. Mm. It's also been reported in virtually every continent except Antarctica, and it's particularly frequent in many parts of Europe and also in southeastern Canada. So again, you can be in various places in the world and still get Lyme disease, and that's important to know, and certainly but there are areas where it is certainly more prevalent. Now, where these ticks hang out, or ticks in general, they tend to, first of all, prefer forested or brushy areas. It's important to know that ticks don't fly, they don't jump. So they're going to crawl from high grass or forested areas onto their host. And the other place where you might find them is in moist areas under leaves, heavy leaf collection. Also, if you have lumber or wood, you can find it in that area too. So where it's less likely are in dry desert-type areas. That's where these ticks do not thrive, but in all these other areas you may find it. There is some seasonality, as you might expect, and you mentioned that we're getting into warmer months right now. So these ticks tend to be most active when the temperature is over 40 degrees. So if you want to take a look at the prime months, we're really talking about generally from April through October. Having said that, though, particularly when we get into a warm winter, you know, I've seen ticks in my own mailbox actually during the middle of winter, so it isn't always the fact that these ticks are not going to be able to continue with their life cycle in an active way during the winter. But in general, we're really talking about times when we have temperatures that are consistently above 40 degrees. So the major months of risk are, I would say, in our area from April through October.
Okay, so you mentioned wooded areas. We have a lot of that, a lot of hiking here. Is there a way to avoid coming into contact with a tick?
Well, that's very important because, as we've often stated with almost everything, that prevention is far better than cure. And so it's important to know how we can kind of prevent this from occurring. So first of all, let's talk about the places where we live. What you want to try and do is to keep your, if you have a lawn, to keep it mowed, to keep weeds, particularly in the border areas, cut down so that they are not elevated. Because again, when they become usually a foot and a half or so, that's what these ticks tend to hang out near the top, and it's much more easily contacted in terms of a human host or, for that matter, animal hosts. So you want to make sure that you do that and that you take care of your own domicile. Secondly, if you're walking through the woods, if it's at all possible to avoid brushy or wooded areas, so be it. Try and do that. If not, you want to make sure that you're wearing proper clothing. So what we're talking about here is long pants, long sleeves, socks, that pants can actually be tucked into your socks. And then you can use certain types of insect repellents that are particularly effective against ticks. And we're talking about primarily permethrin that you can spray your clothing with. And here we're talking about adults. And if you spray your clothing with permethrin, it acts to either kill or prevent ticks from alighting on you. That's very important. And there are ways that you could buy this and spray your clothing in advance. You can also have clothing that's pre-treated with it. There are a number of different ways to make sure that you're using that. And then there are certain types of other insect repellents that are primarily for mosquitoes, but have some element in terms of tick repellent. And here we're talking about DEET. And with that, we know that the concentrations can vary. You really want to use the lowest concentration that's effective, generally somewhere between 20-35%, and apply it over any exposed skin. And there's also oil of eucalyptus, picaridin, as well as some other insect repellents that also may have some effect. But DEET is probably more effective when we're talking about ticks than in terms of mosquitoes. And again, if we're talking about pediatric patients, you want to talk to your pediatrician about some of these things should be used very sparingly, if at all, in children.
Right, right. So let's talk about if you do find a tick on your body, can you pull it off?
Yes. So as I mentioned earlier, that for the tick to transmit Lyme disease, we are generally talking about a period where it should be embedded for more than 24 hours. And these nymphal stages are very, very small when they are really the size of a head of a pin. Mm-hmm. So you may not see it. Now, when it becomes engorged, it's still not all that large. We're talking now about a pencil point or a poppy seed. And oftentimes these ticks are in areas that you may not be very cognizant of, or you can't even view, like your back, the back of your neck and back of your ears. Obviously under your arms, your groin, and these are not unusual areas. So if you come in from being outdoors, you should always have a tick check and maybe have someone else take a look at some of the areas that you can't. Because if you get bitten by a tick and get it off before it's engorged, which usually is more than 24 hours, the chances of getting Lyme disease go down substantially if they exist at all. Mm. That's number one. The second thing is there is a proper way and an improper way to remove ticks. And there are various devices that are kind of handy that you can buy in a lot of different stores, whether they're sporting goods stores or hardware stores that sometimes make it easy. But you can also use a type of tweezer. The important thing is to get down as close to the skin as possible. You don't want to crush that tick, because if you do that, what you're doing is you're forcing the bacteria that are in that tick directly into your bloodstream. So you want to apply gentle pressure on this tick, and what we call traction, where you're gradually, you don't yank it out because you're going to leave some mouth parts in if you do that. But what you do is you gradually pull back and the tick will generally release itself. Some of the things to absolutely not do, which you see sometimes people do, is to try and get it off with a match, a match head or a lit cigarette. Do not do that. That does not work. And again, if you're squeamish about this, there are many, many different, any urgent care center would take care of this for you. So there are a lot of different ways that it can be done, but it must be done properly. The other thing is, if you find that the tick is engorged and it may have been there for more than 24 hours, then it's possible to actually take a prophylactic dose of a medication. Again, this is age-related, usually over the age of 9, where you can take a dose of doxycycline as a single pill, and that cuts down the likelihood of you coming down with the disease as well. So again, a number of different things to consider. And you want to make sure it is the tick that can cause this, which we talked about is a black-legged tick. By the way, a tick is not an insect. An insect has 6 legs. A tick is an arachnid. So it has a similarity with spiders. So in the adult stages, there are 8 legs. And we talked about the black-legged tick or deer tick being very, very small. That's very different than the dog tick, as an example, which is much larger. And that can transmit other diseases like Rocky Mountain spotted fever, but it doesn't transmit Lyme disease. So there are also guides. You can get into the Pennsylvania Department of Health. They have, as soon as you go into the main site, there's actually a place that you can press for Lyme disease, and it has a number of different pictures of the size of these ticks and how they are in comparison to a dime, as an example, so that it can help identify it. And you can then also, if you want to keep that tick, and when you get it off and put it in a place where somebody else can take a look at it and identify it for you, that's perfectly fine too.
So do we destroy the tick when we pull it off, or you said put it into something?
Well, you can keep it. There's also a way, by the way, that some places will process it and try and tell you whether it's more likely that or has Lyme disease in it or not. But again, for most people, if you're getting it off within less than 24 hours, you don't have, and you think that you've gotten every bit of it out. Because if you haven't, then you have to see someone professionally. And it's not very difficult because it isn't a deep embedding that they can get whatever mouth parts might be left in there out. But it is important to do that. So, again, there are a lot of potential options, even for those people who may be squeamish about it.
Yeah, that would be me. So I guess let's get into a little bit more of treatment. If you think you have Lyme disease, how is that diagnosed?
Okay, so there are a number of different issues that have occurred in Lyme disease, and one of the big issues is that we really don't have a great test for it. We have tests that can help support a clinical diagnosis, but the test alone will not make the diagnosis, and that's important. I also want to be very, very clear that there's a lot of controversy in Lyme disease, because I think, you know, when I speak to an audience that's sophisticated, an audience like yours, there are going to be people who feel that there is a traditional way of approaching this, both with treatment and diagnosis, and there's also what might be considered to be a non-traditional way. And I'm not here to tell you what's absolutely right or absolutely wrong. I think people who know me know that at times, particularly with COVID, that I've disagreed with the CDC on how it's been handled, so I'm not afraid to do so. But I'm also not afraid to agree with it if I think they're correct. But Lyme disease, like many other things, is a dynamic, and we're constantly learning about it. So, you know, what I want to make sure is that people at least treat this respectfully, that there are a number of different opinions out there, and I'm not here to tell you that one is absolutely right and one is absolutely wrong. It doesn't prevent me from having an opinion, and that's subject to change as there is more and more evidence that accumulates, and that's the way we deal with medicine as a whole. So I want to make sure that your audience who may be more attached to a non-traditional approach understands that I have respect for that and I have respect for the emotions that go along with it. So in terms of treatment, there are a number of different antibiotics that are used to treat. Again, if we're speaking about early stages, when it doesn't involve, for instance, the central nervous system or hasn't been around for years or has major cardiac issues, et cetera, then usually you're talking about a 14 to 21 day course of therapy. Drugs that are frequently used are drugs like amoxicillin if you're talking about children, doxycycline in general for adults, but there are certainly other drugs that have also been tried and true in this regard. Generally, a single treatment course should be sufficient, and this is where a lot of the debate comes in, because after treatment, there is or a number of people, maybe 10% of people, where some of those symptoms will continue. And there is a lot of controversy surrounding that, that traditionally there's a feeling that a lot of this, which can be sometimes called either chronic Lyme disease or post-treatment Lyme syndrome, the traditional way of thinking about this is that this is an inflammatory reaction, that further courses of antibiotics are not likely to help. The non-traditional way of thinking about it is that there still may be activity, and so that there are people who will look and find practitioners that will give them multiple courses of antibiotics. So I want to make sure that people understand that there is this difference. I certainly, at this point in time, I'm much more adherent to the traditional viewpoint. But again, I want to point out that I have respect for the fact that we don't have all the answers. So it's like everything else. It's a caveat emptor, the buyer must beware in this, because not everyone who has a non-traditional approach, and for that matter, not everyone who has a traditional approach, is absolutely right.
Right. So I guess if we're going to ask about it being curable.
So the again, as I mentioned, that if you're dealing with this in the early stages, the earliest stages, and you're getting a traditional form of therapy, the likelihood of a cure is extremely high. But you may still have some symptoms that in a small percentage that will linger for a period of time.
Okay. And what happens if you don't treat it?
So if you don't treat it, that's where the issues can really come in. Because as I pointed out, that people can then develop true arthritis. They can develop meningitis. They can develop heart block. That then requires additional treatment or more aggressive types of treatment. I mean, these are some of the examples that I can give you. There are others. So the point is early treatment, early diagnosis is preferable. The test is supportive. There are several FDA tests. You have to know what laboratory is doing this, because there are some laboratories that are private laboratories that will literally come up with a positive in everyone. So again, I have faith in certain laboratories, particularly if you're talking about ones that are associated with a recognized medical center or a university. And usually it's a two-step process that usually requires a confirmation, an initial test and a confirmatory test. That has to be, again, coupled with your clinical diagnosis. The test alone can't be used to make the diagnosis solely, and it cannot be used as a test for cure. So we have a lot of work to do to get a much better test, which I think we're really involved in doing that, and hopefully that'll put a lot of these controversies to rest, but right now it doesn't exist. Now, we can also talk about vaccines in terms of prevention. What some people may know is that there was a human vaccine that became available and then was taken off the market about 22 years ago in 2002. And there were a number of reasons why it was taken off the market. It really didn't prove to be the best of vaccines for a variety of different circumstances. There is work currently being done by a number of different drug companies to develop a much better vaccine, because some of us who are exposed to these things all the time, if you're an outdoors person, you know, or your job entails you being in the outdoors and in brushy areas, it might be something for you to consider. But we don't have that kind of vaccine right now. And then there are other prophylactic endeavors that are being done, that are being looked at. So I think we're going to see the change in this over the next probably 5 years. Now, having said this, there is a vaccine for dogs.
Yeah.
So maybe we can talk a little bit about pets, because it does get confusing. I mean, why is there a vaccine for dogs, but we don't have a vaccine for humans? But
I did want to ask, as far as the test itself, is it a blood test?
Yes.
Okay, so you're
testing.
Yeah,
I mean,
the
it
blood.
Is generally a blood test that's okay. done. That's the most frequent way of doing it. Sometimes if you're looking for central nervous system Lyme disease and someone's had a spinal tap, as an example, you can send off spinal fluid, or if you have joint involvement, you can send off joint fluid. But again, I want to point out that the tests themselves are not absolutely diagnostic. They can help you, but the ones that exist right now are need to be coupled with your clinical acumen and suspicion.
And if it comes back as a negative, if you have the blood test, comes back as a negative, you can still have all these other clinical...
Well, I'm glad you brought that out, because if you have testing that's done within the first 6 weeks, as an example, that test is oftentimes negative. And so if you're coming in with a rash, as an example, in the very early stages, and you get treated, not only will you likely have a negative test, but you probably will not develop a positive test even later on. So that's important. The second thing to understand is, as a bacterial illness, you don't get immunity with this. So you can't say, well, you know, I had Lyme disease once and therefore I'm not going to get it again. That's just not true. Unfortunately, there is no immunity with this, and you can have it multiple times.
Okay. Well, I do want to talk about our furry friends.
Okay. So, you know, one of the things is, can animals get this disease? And the answer is, in many cases, they can. In other cases, the animals can carry the disease but don't actually show signs of it. As we've talked about, it's a deer tick, but the deer are not sick with this, as an example, and the mice are not usually sick with this. So they are carriers, they help spread it, but they are not sick with it. Now, on the other hand, there are animals that do get sick with it, and dogs primarily are one of the major pets in that regard. Cats can get it, but in general, they don't display the symptoms and they're less likely to have it. I want to put a disclaimer here. I am not a veterinarian, so if someone, right. You know, I don't want to compete with my veterinary colleagues, but you can certainly check these things out with your veterinarian. And then lastly, horses. And that I can speak of, you know, personally having to treat a horse, which is not a pleasant position when you're having to put multiple pills in a horse's mouth. horses, in fact, can get and do get Lyme disease. So what we're really talking about primarily here when it comes to pets are dogs and horses. The vaccine is available only for dogs as of right now, and that's something that if you think that your dog is at particular risk for, you may want to certainly talk to your veterinarian. So the symptoms that a dog can have with this is they can become somewhat lethargic, they can become lame, they can end up with enlarged lymph nodes, they can end up with swelling of their joints. Horses, in a similar manner, can display symptoms in those regards. You know, there is treatment for animals, and again, I want to make sure that I'm not embarking on the veterinary world, and I would say if you think you have these, check with your veterinarian. I think everything that we would say that we would certainly agree on is prevention over here. So if you're walking your dog and you have a chance, and hopefully if you can avoid very wooded or brushy areas, so much the better. Tick checks, just as we talked about with humans, should be done on your dog, and they should be removed promptly and adequately. There are insect and certain repellents that are safe for pets. Again, I would say check with your veterinarian, and they can advise you whether it's proper in your particular case. So, number one, it can do this. Number two, it's preventable and should be preventable, and it is something to really think about because it can be very disabling in a dog and certainly in a horse. There is one other thing that I think it's important to mention, and that's what I would call co-infection. That the same tick, in this case the black-legged tick, that can transmit Lyme disease can also transmit certain other diseases such as anaplasmosis, you know, and babesiosis. These are two other diseases, and we do know, and actually we were the first individuals to report babesia in Pennsylvania, in people who had not traveled outside of the state. So the range of these things has increased, and there are a number of ticks that can be infected with more than one disease and transmit more than one disease. So it's just something that we need to be aware of. Stroudsburg has done a lot of work on this and continues to do a lot of work on it, but it is something to be aware of that sometimes the treatment is different if you are co-infected with more than one disease.
Okay. Well, I think the bottom line is check yourself and your pets if you've been out in nature and prevent it from occurring with proper gear and repellent.
And be aware.
Be aware. Thank you so much, Dr. Jerry, for joining us tonight. And as always, thanks to St. Luke's for supporting this show.
You're quite welcome. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you. If you would like to listen to this program again, please go to WDIY.org or the WDIY app or your favorite podcast platform. Thank you for listening tonight on WDIY. Have a great evening.
If you enjoyed this program, please go to WDIY.org or the WDIY app to share or become a WDIY member.